Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5, for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 3, delivered on August 29, 2017. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve.
Tonight, the Federal Reserve. I'm going to start with a question, just a simple question. You should be able to answer this quite well. Let me look at someone who wants to have a very simple question. Sir, what is money?
Currency.
That's one very narrow kind of money, but it's an example. Money. Madam, what's money? Yeah, power. Yeah. Have any of you seen the television show House of Cards? They've got an explanation of power in there that's very interesting. Okay, let's start with a story. I'm looking for the appropriate person for this story, and I'm trying to think who would you, sir? You and I are both cavemen. Okay, we live in caves. That's why they call us cavemen. Okay. Now, this is back in the Paleolithic times, maybe into the Chalcolithic. Now, you are a moose hunter. You hunt moose. You have gotten yourself a moose. And you've got it over your shoulder, walking along. Got moose. You can pull it back and forth like this, because, you know, those antlers are great back scratchers. Get rid of some of that Paleolithic hair on your back and all that. And you come to my cave, because I make apple pie. Good apple pies. I mean, they're the best apple pies anyone... Dean Winchester eats them, if any of you know the reference to Supernatural. But anyway, no one does. Okay. So, okay, here's the thing. You say, I've got moose. And I say, well, I've got pie. Okay, so let's trade. And I say, I'll tell you what, I'll give you two of my pies for that moose. No deal. I want four of your pies. And I think about it, yeah, that's a pretty decent moose, yeah. And so, fine, I say, deal. Four of my pies for a moose. Well, a little while later, sometime down the road, you, madam, hunt elk. And you come to my cave and say, I've got elk. And I say, well, I've got pies. And so you say, I know, right? So I've got an elk, you've got pies, let's do a deal. I look at that elk, I say, yeah, that one's going to be, I want that elk. That's definitely an elk, and I want that elk. It's great, you know, to take out on a date, you know. You got fur, you got meat, you got antlers, the whole nine yards. Who would say no to that on a date, okay? So you say five pies, and I say deal. So I've traded five pies for an elk. Those pies are money. No question about it, they are money. Because money is actually any asset that is widely accepted in exchange for other assets. Money is any asset that is widely accepted in exchange for other assets. These were accepted in exchange, and clearly there are cave people who will accept these pies. They come to me, and they take pies. It becomes a common denominator. So now we know that four pies equals a moose, five pies equals an elk. So we've even got a basis for comparing moose and elk. Elk is slightly more valuable than moose. 1.25 elk to the moose. Okay, to the moose. Okay? So, that might sound, well, that's kind of ridiculous. No, absolutely not. That is a specific kind of money, the most common money in history, still used to this day. It is called barter money. Barter money. The characteristic of barter money, well, there are a couple, but one of the characteristics of barter money is that it has full intrinsic value. You can either trade that elk or you can eat that elk, all of that elk. You can even gnaw on the antlers. Give your teeth some workout. You see those pies, you can eat the whole pie. That pie is money. And it also has that very special thing about some monies that it is fully and completely consumable. You go home, you eat my pie. You even eat the crust. I make a killer crust, flaky, you know. Anyway, and special request, I'll do the lattice thing with the pie crust top and maybe a little sprinkle of sugar and all that. I know, right? It's good. Okay, so this kind of money is the most common kind of money historically. The idea that everyone had money in the currency, you know, paper and coins, now that's actually fairly modern. Even in the medieval times, there weren't a lot of people who had actual coin money of any kind. That was restricted to the wealthiest. In ancient empires, we find coins, but those were coins that were held by the wealthy and the merchant class. But even the professional class probably rarely had, they'd never seen it. One of the great stories that is an economics and finance story and a labor theory story from ancient times is about the Egyptian Empire during the pharaohs. Now, the idea that the pyramids were built with slave labor is a myth. They were built by professionals. The scribes, the artisans, the engineers, the workers themselves were professional teams that actually, you can go inside the chambers and pyramids and you will see when a chamber was completed, the logo of the building team. We did this. This is our logo. They were highly motivated, but they were not paid in currency. They didn't pay the workers in currency. The scribes, the artisans, the engineers, the builders, they were paid in food, booze, food, and forgive me for saying this, in women. They were paid for in entertainment. That was what they got. Now, something about the Egyptians was that the scribes wrote detailed, extensive, meticulous records of everything that happened. And they were quite honest and quite glib. If they lost a battle, the scribes would go, yeah, we got our butts kicked in that battle. Yeah, we're going to go back home and figure out what happened. They would describe when slaves escaped. They would describe when plagues hit. They described during the time of one of the pharaohs. See, a lot of those pharaohs, they were not popular at all, especially the ones who went completely overboard building pyramids because it sapped the economic strength of the economy of that time. And it just pissed a lot of people off. But they spent like a fortune to build these pyramids at the expense of other things that they could have been doing with that money. But one way or the other. Anyway, pharaohs write a story, or rather the scribes write the story, that during the building of a pyramid by one of the pharaohs, the scribes, the engineers and the workers were really getting upset because they didn't think Pharaoh was paying them enough for what they were doing. And so we have recorded in the hieroglyphs the first labor strike ever documented in history. They stopped working on the pyramid until you pay us more. Well, there was a discussion in the inner circle of the Pharaoh. We can't let this happen. They're defying a living God. How can you let them do this? Let us go in and let us execute one of every 10. Let's decimate their ranks. That'll teach them. Then there were a couple of wise heads who said, you're going to kill one of every 10 of the scribes, right? Yeah. Okay, those scribes are the ones who write on the walls after you die, Pharaoh. They're the ones who write the directions for you to get to heaven. Yeah, that's going to be a good idea. We can't read those, but what's going to happen is that they're going to write directions to the sewer on the outside of town. Yeah, there's a good idea. And those builders, well, they're smart enough, and the engineers are smart enough, they could probably build those so that they fell apart after 50 years, and then where is your mummy then? In a pile of rubble. Ultimately, Pharaoh blinked, and they actually conceded, and the scribes, engineers, artisans, and workers did get more food, more wine, more entertainment. There you go. You don't need currency to have economic activity. You don't need currency to have disputes over wages. You don't need currency to build monumental structures. So that gives you an idea. Barter money is not primitive. Barter money is what, I mean, haven't you ever done something to get something and there was no money exchanged? The barter economy still exists to this day. Now, the next step in the evolution of money was more what you might think of, what we call commodity money. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as metal money. Metal money has some intrinsic value. It doesn't have full intrinsic value. My pies, you could eat completely and make them go away. With metal money, you can still use the metal. Go.
Did you say barter money had all intrinsic
value? All full intrinsic value. Full. And then metal money has partial. Like, for example, an interesting thing we see sometimes when we're in archaeological excavations, we will find spearheads, metal spearheads. But if you look closely, the spearheads have pieces of inscriptions on them. That was where some coin had been during a time of war hammered into a spear point. To this day, we can use metals as currencies, but we can also use them as conducting materials and electronics and all kinds of other things. They don't have full consumable, you can't fully consume them. So it's only partial. But they still have intrinsic value that is noticeable, notable. Now we come to the third one. The third one is what is called fiat money. It's actually pronounced fiat, but I've been told it's better to pronounce it fiat these days. But fiat money is money that is money only by decree of the sovereign. It has very little intrinsic value. It has a little tiny bit, but this dollar bill says this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. The sovereign says you must accept this in exchange by law. Truth be told, this has a tiny bit. You know, I could blow my nose on it, you know, take it to the bathroom, that kinds of things. But so there is a little bit of value. But the only reason people really use it is because it is easy to use. It has high liquidity. And we are ordered to accept it. I can't say no to a dollar bill. I wouldn't, unless they asked me to do something I didn't want. But look, fiat money is the one you're most used to. But now you live in a time, and this is one of those fun things. I can show you a fourth that I wouldn't have shown 20 years ago, teaching a class just like this. It would not have existed. The fourth one are the cryptocurrencies. a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. Bitcoin is an example of a crypto. It has exactly zero intrinsic value. It has no physical existence whatsoever. That dollar bill had a tiny bit. It was a piece of paper I could use for something else. But the cryptos, they have zero, exactly zero. They are the final evolution of money. And they are coming. Already there are places that accept cryptocurrency for purchases. There are some companies now offering to pay you in crypto, in bitcoins. It's happening. But know this. Whenever a new currency type comes along, it doesn't wipe out the old one. Every one that comes along is a layer on top of an old one that still can be used and still is used. So there is no historical evidence whatsoever that the cryptos will wipe out fiat money. Well, someday there will be no dollar bills. Yes, there will. Historically, we don't see. When the commodity money started showing up, barter still happened. When the fiat started showing up, there were still commodities, still barter. You know, that realistically, these just simply add a layer onto the last one. Now, I just brought up a term called liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be traded for another. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be traded for another. Now, there is an incorrect version of this that says liquidity is how quickly an asset can be traded for cash. No, that's not correct. Cash is just a highly liquid asset. But assets, notice how these assets actually are in ascending order of liquidity. Barter money is not liquid. It is not easy, not efficient. It's highly inefficient. Commodity monies are more efficient, more liquid, but you still, if someone hands me a gold coin, I'm going to have to wait and see if that's real gold. Fiat monies are highly liquid. Let me give you an example. You, sir, can take a dollar bill and buy a cheapo burger at McDonald's. That means that cash is extremely liquid. It's highly, highly liquid. Okay. However, you yourself are an asset, but you are highly illiquid. You have an extraordinary amount of value, but it takes your whole life to extract all of that. It takes a lot of development, and it takes a lot of re-education over the years to keep the cash flow from your asset going. Okay, so I can't take you to McDonald's and say, here, I want a burger for this. They're going to say, really? They're going to look at that, you know, unshaven look. Yeah, there's kind of a coolness to it, but really, how are we going to, you know, can he really work a cash register? So you see, I can't get another asset for you very quickly at all. So you are illiquid. And however, the dollar is highly liquid. So we think about liquidity in terms of currencies. We think about liquidity in terms of assets. One thing about liquidity is the higher the liquidity, the faster I can get something else for it. But also, interestingly enough, the higher the liquidity, the less I can get a return on the investment. Because it's highly liquid, I can't commit it for a long period of time. I would have to convert it to something that is much less liquid to get a high ROI, return on investment, out of it. So companies that keep a lot of cash on hand, we say that's great, you can pay your bills right away. That's wonderful. But we get worried when a company has too much cash on hand because that high liquidity means that it's not putting that into long-term assets that are less liquid but could earn it a higher return. Like a factory. So we see a company like Netflix, which is flush flush with cash. And we know they're not stupid. We know that with that much cash, they've got to be planning to turn that into a less liquid, more higher return asset. So that's a clue when we look at companies. Are they? Do they have a lot of liquidity? Do they have too much or too little? You don't want them to have too little because then they can't pay their immediate bills. So there's a balancing act we look at with liquidity. But anyway, that's the concept of barter. Money and commodity money, fiat money, and the one new in your lifetimes. Now, truth be told, there was actually an experiment in the, I think it was the early 1990s, with a kind of crypto. If I'm not mistaken, it was early Amazon was doing it. They had an Amazon, or maybe it was Apple. It was, I think it was Apple Purse or something like that. It didn't go anywhere because there was just no way that people could wrap their minds around something like this. It's almost like you can invent something, but that doesn't mean that it will take off if people don't have a context and understanding of what's around that. This was before most people had any idea that there was such a thing as the internet. In the early 90s, the internet was only a couple of years old. Those of us who were working in IT, like me, we knew that there was something out there. It wasn't called the internet like at that time. It was called ARPANET. But hardly anyone had any concept that computers could be used to trade. And so this crypto, the first crypto, didn't happen. Not because it wasn't a good idea, but because it wasn't time for it yet. Now it is coming to be the time for it. Now I'm going to switch this over from type, oh, by the way, when I talk like this and I keep repeating definitions, I can promise you that that is great bait for quick questions on my midterm exams. And that's a question like, what are the types of money? That would be a great question. So that's why you should write notes very carefully when I say things, especially when I repeat a definition. You'll get used to that. Now, monetary aggregates. This is something somewhat related in terms of liquidity. Monetary aggregates. We start with, now here we're talking about fiat monies. Eventually, the officialdom of the world takes a while to catch up. So really, in the longer run, this would also have to do with cryptocurrencies as well, but it doesn't because there's not a frame of mind for the official financial system to fully integrate the cryptos, although financial institutions are now collecting and reserving cryptos. But anyway, the first one is M0. You probably won't hear about this one. I don't know if they even mentioned this in your econ class. M0 is the base money supply. It is nothing but coin and currency in circulation. In other words, the most highly liquid of the monetary aggregates. It's just the pure fiat money in its physical form, coins and currencies. Now, most financial people don't even care about M0. I am one of the few who actually likes to keep an eye on it because it says things as that expands and contracts. It says things about the condition of the economy that the larger aggregates don't. Now, the one that is the most common that people think of is M1. M1 is M0 plus some other highly, highly liquid forms of fiat. Demand deposits at banks are in M1. They're highly liquid. You can use your debit card and instantly get food. You can write a check from a bank. And then there was one that's not very popular anymore, but it's highly liquid, but I don't know. Have any of you ever used traveler's checks? They used to be very popular because you could get your money turned into traveler's checks, go overseas, and if you lost them, you got your money back right away. They were accepted everywhere. But they still include that one because there are some people who still use them. Like I said, they used to be very popular, but not anymore, really. All of these are highly liquid, but only the M0 is the most liquid, but they're all highly, highly liquid. You can very efficiently, and when I say efficiently, I mean quickly and at little or no cost. Now the next one is M2. M2 has M1 plus smaller time deposits. And by small, I'm talking about CDs that would be less than $10 million. Not as liquid. Because remember, with CDs, there's a substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal. So you could get your money, but it would not be efficient to do so because there would be a substantial cost involved. And finally, the 800-pound gorilla, M3, which is M2 plus large time deposits. And I'm talking about things like $100 million CDs, $1 billion CD or something like that. If there's such a thing, I don't know. Plus the biggie. The euro dollars. Despite its name, euro dollar doesn't mean Europe. It means the world outside of the United States. Think about this. Sir, you are a producer, an industrial producer, a manufacturer in China. Okay? I am an American consumer. You make toasters. I buy toasters. So let's say that you want to charge 10 American dollars for a toaster. I buy that toaster for $10. You never see $10. You never will. That $10 goes to the People's Bank of China, which reserves as euro dollars 10 American dollars, then they pay you in the currency of China, the yuan. Okay? So euro dollars are the foreign reserves of American dollars held in central banks of other countries. In no country could a producer actually get American dollars. They get the local currency. Their central bank gets the American dollars and then gives the domestic producers the local money. So as those euro dollars accumulate across the world in different countries, when we buy oil from another country, the actual oil extractors don't ever see dollars. They see their local currency. The central bank of that oil-producing country actually gets the dollars. Now that is what we mean by euro dollars. Those American dollars that are in the foreign reserves of central banks all over the world outside of the United States. That's the interesting thing, because as we import goods, we export American dollars. So what is that Central Bank of China going to do with those American dollars? The only place a currency can be spent is in the country of minting, the origin country. So as China, Japan, European countries, the OPEC countries, as they accumulate American dollars, the only place they can spend them is back here. And so they do as long-term investments. They are the ones who lend our government all the money so that we can have two theater wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, so that you can borrow money more than you can possibly pay back in your lifetime, so that you can have your student loans, so you can have your nice house, so you can have your car. That is not our money, because we don't tax ourselves enough to do that. So we borrow the money, we export our dollars to all these countries around the world, which then lend the money back to our government and to our corporations and to us, so that we can live way beyond the means that would be possible with tax revenues. That's how we do it. That's how we have been doing it. And so M3 has been skyrocketing over the years. It was actually M3 stopped skyrocketing during the 1990s, but then with the wars that we got into and all the other things that were going on, the euro dollar started stacking up again. So that is M3, highly illiquid, but it's also the one that kind of gets us a little bit worried, because for those American dollars we're getting so that we can live beyond our means, we are committing future expected cash flows to pay them back, dollar for dollar plus interest. Whenever we take money from those foreign reserves, whenever we take a loan, either as a government, as a school district, as a corporation, or as a family, we will have to pay it back with interest. And that also creates a political problem, because as those countries lend us money, they can start to tell us what we can and can't do. Just like any lender, they can begin to dictate to us. Either directly or through subterfuge, they can make us dance to their tune, because we are hooked on money that we don't earn and gather and save ourselves. Okay, now let me go on here. This is the backdrop to talk about the Federal Reserve. But in order to talk about the Federal Reserve, I have to tell you a little bit about history. And I'm not going to be pleasant about this, probably not the history that you would hear about in textbooks. No matter what era we're in, conservative or liberal. First things first, our financial system historically has been driven by wealthy, powerful interests. And scammers, con men, working side by side with decent, law-abiding, God-fearing people. Our government, from the time of George Washington on, has been the best government money can buy. George Washington himself, he and his whiskey cronies really pissed off the whiskey makers in the Tennessee and Ohio Valley with their shenanigans. In the pre-Civil War era, the bankers in the North and the shipping interests in the North made sure that the South stayed crippled. And then they all got... I won't get into that. It's politically incorrect now, but there was a lot of bitterness, anger, hatred in the South because of them northern banksters and what they were doing in the shipping merchants. And then they would pay by Congress, and Congress would pass tariff acts that were adverse to the interests of the producers in the South. So you've got a lot of steaming, seething hatred of the North American American bankers in the North, in New York City. Now, follow that up. In the post-Civil War era, it didn't get better, it got worse. The northern bankers, the scammers, the con men, there were no laws. It was a Wild West. Have any of you ever seen the movie Gangs of New York? It is a painful movie because it's about New York City in the 1800s. But you swear you're watching a movie about the Wild West. It was just madness. Gangs, murder, summary execution, illegal dealing, hardly anything that would be conceivable as law enforcement was going on. In the post-Civil War era, banks were, a lot of them were fly-by-night operations, and so many people, working-class people, middle-class people, even upper-middle-class people, kept getting screwed by the banks. Because the banks would collapse, and you just lost your money. There wasn't anything you could do. You go to your bank one morning, and the bank is closed. That's the end. All the money you had there was gone. On the border, in the border states, you would have the mud banks. They'd be in business for a couple of months, and they'd give you their phony currency for your gold that you put in there. And then when the bank collapsed, you couldn't do anything with that mud bank currency. It was a fiasco going on. Now, here is one of the problems that would happen. There were legitimate bankers. There were these, kind of almost like that classic example of the mousy banker with a bald pate working on his books and writing entries day and night and being very disciplined. There were a lot of bankers like that, but they were tended to be preyed upon by the bad guys. A typical bank if it is responsible, will go like this. You, sir, found $100. So you quickly take it to my bank. Money in bank. $100. Now, if I am a responsible banker, I have two things that I have to do. One is to protect you, and two is to stay in business by making money. So what I will do is I will put some of your money in the vault, not to be touched. That's because you might come in and ask for a little bit of your money. You might write a check to him, and he comes in with a demand deposit on your a demand draft on your account, so I've got to honor his check. So I have to keep some of your money in the bank. But what that means then is that available capital in the bank would be $80. Now you, madam, come to me and you say, well, I want to start a business and I'd like a loan. And I say, well, I've got $80 I can lend at 5% interest. See, that's how I'm going to make money and make a profit so I can pay my employees and give myself incentive to do this. So I say, okay, well, yeah, I'll lend you $80. So you are lent I lend you $80. You have this lady build your business. You give her the $80. She comes to my bank and deposits $80. Okay, well, I'm going to keep on my books 20% of that. Let's say it's a 20% reserve. So that's $16. So from that, I will have $64. Now, you come to me and say, I've got a business idea, and I'd like to borrow some money. So I say, I've got $64, and you say, I'd like that. And so I lend you $64. You pay your workers and all that. They come to my bank, and they put that $64 in my bank. Do you see what's happening to the money supply? The book value of the bank is going up. At this point, it started with $100 real dollars. But by the time we get to this point, we got $244 on the books of the bank. And you're saying, now, wait a minute, this is phony. Yeah, this is how it works. This is exactly how it works. By the time this is over, round after round, ultimately, the amount of money in the economy as represented on the books of the bank is $500. How do I know that? Because the way it will work is the change in the money supply will be the original amount of money times 1 over the reserve ratio. So in this case, it would be $100 times 1 over 0.20, the 500. That's how it works. That's one of the ways the money supply grows. Here's the trick, though. You have got to remain reliable. The banker can't have everyone get scared and run in and get the money out of the bank. That would be called a run on the bank. If you came in and said, I want 80 of my dollars, I say, I don't have it. I am immediately insolvent. My door's closed. Imagine banks, what was happening in the 1800s. People would panic and they would run to their banks, and the banks didn't have that all that money. Some of them didn't even keep reserves. There was no requirement, broadly speaking. The banks would just fold up. They would just die. And you would have a whole cascade of banks around a bank crisis all around a neighborhood or in a part of a city. It was a fiasco. Everyone lost their money when this happened. And then the real trick, what would happen in some cases, I'm a powerful family in New York City. I've got media outlets. I run the newspapers in town. I have connections to all of the important people. Did you hear that his bank is in trouble? You better run and get your money. Everyone runs. They find out your bank doesn't have all their money. They don't understand required reserve. And then what they do is they see your, oh God, his bank fell. Everyone better run to that. If you got money in her bank, everyone runs to your bank. You fold. And then everyone sees that that bank folded. That was supposed to be a good bank. My bank's a good bank. Oh, I better run. Everyone runs to your bank. You fold. Even if you got reserves, they're not going to be enough for everyone running. And you can have a collapse. And then I, the one who started this, can then go in and buy up these banks at pennies on the dollar and consolidate market control in the banking sector, in a neighborhood, in a part of the city, in a region of the country. This is how it was being done. So it was Wild West. It was just insane. Then you had these people, these banks that were offering, look, here's what I need. I need to start with $1 million. I'm going to take an investment from you, and in a year, I'll give you back $5 million. Well, that sounds like an incredible deal. So you take it. And you know what I do with that $1 million? I enjoy it. I spend it. And then in about 9 months, what I do is I know I'm going to have to give you $5 million, so I go to you and I say, I need $10 million. And I'm going to give you $20 million back. Well, you'll give me the $10 million, and then I can pay you off, and then I can live well again for another year until I need that to be able to pay you $20 million. I go to you for $50 million. And then I can pay you off. And every time the people are saying, oh, he pays off these great investments. Do you see what I'm doing? I'm doing a pyramid scheme. I'm pyramiding up the ladder. This was really, really common back in that time. People lost their shirts. One of the awful, painful stories was that after the Civil War, one of these pyramid schemes was running, and they got... After General Grant had finished his presidency, the scammers talked him into representing them, being the face of their scam. He didn't understand finance at all. He was just happy to do something, you know. And what he did was, he, being the general of all those Union troops, they all committed their whole pensions to his deal. Well, if the general says this is good, then it's good enough for me, and we'll live a lot better in retirement than we would have otherwise. Well, of course, the scam fell apart, and General Grant, he fell into throat cancer, died, and left many, if not most, of the Civil War veterans of the North penniless in their old age. He really didn't know what he'd done. He didn't understand, but he did understand that it was his fault. And he became quite a recluse in his last year. He moved to a woodland area, and he would sit on his porch, cold or warm, and he was writing his memoirs. The tragic thing is that it was a pilgrimage for many of the veterans, the ones he had screwed too. They would go there, they would walk up that long hill, and they would see him at a distance sitting on the porch writing his memoirs, and they would salute him, and then they would leave. So it's just a poignant story, but it also gives you an idea of just how bad this situation was. Enter the early 20th century, the second decade of the 20th century. By this time, the fiasco had created recessions. Enough banks had collapsed in some cases that the whole economy of the country suffered one recession after another. Plus, even more importantly, rich people were getting caught up in these scandals and getting screwed. And once you can screw all the poor people, the middle class people you want, but when you make the wealthy people mad, well then, by God, we need reform right now. Central banks, bank of the country, had been in Europe for a long time. In fact, the precursors of central banks, at least in a couple of cases, had shown up in the 1600s. In much of Europe, central banks had already shown up in the 19th century. Well, we got around to it in the early 20th century. There was an odd little period in the second decade where there was more of a reform-minded, forward-looking political atmosphere in Congress, in the presidency. And so in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act was passed. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913, I think it was 13. It established a central bank with three jobs. But first, what it did was it established a board of governors for the Federal Reserve Bank. This is seven people, historically of impeccable credentials, the cream of the crop of the banking industry, finance, economics, accounting, really high. They are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Historically, they've been the cream of the crop. In recent years, in the 21st century, there have been some pretty dodgy governors appointed by both the Bush administration and after that, the Obama administration. Not exactly as high quality, although some of the... Now, with this seven, inside of this seven is a chairman. Now, don't let me fool you on a quiz. There are seven governors plus a chairman. No, the chairman is one of the seven. Don't let me bluff you like that. Now, below them, the country is divided into 12 districts. Each district has a region of the country, and it is run by a district bank president. These presidents of the banks are cream of the crop. They are consummate business, political. They are above reproach. I've met several of them. They just exude this kind of, this is a person who's never had a traffic ticket. This is a person who doesn't have sex. This is not a normal human being. These are like somewhere in the stratosphere. Of course, I didn't care. I just walked up to one of them, and he, you know, fortunately, he didn't have his bodyguards near him. But anyway, strangely, though, when the Federal Reserve was established early in the 20th century, the eastern part of the United States was densely populated. The western part was sparsely populated. So they made the eastern districts very small, and they made the western districts huge. But unfortunately, a lot of people have moved west, so the San Francisco Bank, which covers a large area, is now up to its ears because it's got so many banks to regulate and supervise in it, or to supervise. So historically, there's a little oddness. Here in right where we are, we're actually near the border of two districts, Chicago to the north and St. Louis to the south. And we are actually in the Chicago, but I think it's only about 40 miles south of here. Those banks in that area would be down there, would be in the St. Louis district. Every bank has its own character. The New York Bank is the Empire Bank. It sort of is the God Bank. Interestingly, the St. Louis Bank, District Bank, is oftentimes considered the education center. They produce educational materials, a lot of those. They do a lot of work with a lot of things that are outreach. Now, I took my students to the St. Louis Fed about 3 years ago. They just laid out the red carpet for us. They had some of their top people come and speak. They offered internships. They offered jobs. They'll pay for your education clear through your PhD. It was quite a show. It was really nice. But, of course, no one wanted a job done. That's St. Louis. I want to go back to Chicago where my parents live or something like that. Well, a few years ago, I took them up to the Chicago Fed. The problem is that they didn't want to really put on a presentation. So all we could go into this exhibit area. There's this inside of every Fed. There's this place where you can see $1 million. You can see money shredded. You can see all the little posters showing how the Fed works. And that was not a pleasant experience at all because we got all packed into this one room right before the security gates to go into the exhibit room, the exhibition room. And all my students there was this huge security guard. I mean, this monster. I mean, big. And they all, she leads all of them in, and I'm following them in, and she hits me with her nightstick. You know, ow, damn you, ham beast. That hurt. Turned out she was great. We had drinks later. But anyway, not friendly. They're not, they don't have to be. They're Chicago. You ever been to Chicago? The disrespect you get up there is part of the bill you pay for your sandwich at the shop that I go to. Okay. Three duties of the Fed. The Federal Reserve was established to do three things. First, it regulates and supervises banks. It regulates and supervises banks. Regulation is done by the Board of Governors. Supervision is done by the district banks. Understand this. Business law actually doesn't really exist for a business. Business law is overseen in interpretation by an agency or a commission. Environmental law is overseen by the Environmental Protection Agency. Securities law is overseen by the Securities and Exchange Commission. So in other words, the commission itself actually interprets the law and writes the regulations for business to follow to comply with the law. That's how it works. It's not true, well, we abide by the law. No, we abide by what the regulations tell us. The regulations are what the commission's experts tell us is the right way to behave under that law. So the Board of Governors says, all right, these are the laws of banks. So what we do is we write the regulations for those laws. And then we tell the supervising authorities, the district banks, you go to the banks and look at how they are behaving according to the regulations. So regulates and supervises. Regulation, Board of Governors, supervision, the 12 district banks. And by the way, I'm going to try. There are other actual agencies that oversee certain types of banks. I've been given a request by the Comptroller of the Currency. They oversee certain types of banks, and they have teams in all areas of the country, and they're looking for new people to join their teams. You just travel around the area auditing banks to see if they're in compliance with regulations of the Comptroller of the Currency. And they're always looking for new people. I think I've had four of my former students get jobs with the Comptroller on those teams. They actually love the work. But that's down the road. Okay, second thing. The Federal Reserve is a bank for banks. A bank has to have a place to put its money. A bank needs a checking account. The Federal Reserve actually operates in competition with private commercial banks that provide the same services to banks. The way it works is this. The Fed is charged under its laws with first never trying to cheat predatory pricing or anything like that, the private banks it's competing against. They're not allowed to do that. The second thing is the Federal Reserve must spend just like a drunken sailor on new technologies all the time, and when they develop them, they have to share them for free with their private competitor banks. So I'm the Fed, you're a private commercial bank, you're a bank. You could choose to use my services at the Fed, or you could choose to use his. But you know that if I've got some new trick, he has it too because I am forced to give it to him. I have to give it to him. This is why we have all these new technologies. Like back in the day, you remember, you've probably seen checks with those black numbers at the bottom that's magnetic numbers. That was a Fed thing, and they shared the technology with every bank, commercial bank in the country so that the technology would diffuse. ATM technology. The big thing right now is security of the banking system. So the Fed is the one doing it. Now, the Fed actually, when the money it makes, a private bank, that's your shareholders' money, the profit. with the Fed, it gives that money back to the Treasury. Every year, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. It just gives to the Treasury. Here, this is your money. So it disgorges its money every year back to the government. Now, the interesting part of this is, well, someone asked me, it's been more than a few years ago, someone asked me, okay, well, how many banks go with the Fed and how many go with private commercial banks? I didn't know the answer, so I called some friends of mine down at the St. Louis Fed, and the one said, at this time for the St. Louis district, 65% about of the banks use the Fed as their bank, and 35% use commercial banks, private commercial banks, as their bank. So that's about the balance. The interesting part of this is, if you think about it, this is an example of an entity that goes in direct competition against private providers of the same exact service. And the relationship does not destroy the private sector component, and it benefits everyone, including the private sector competitors, in the process. When there was the discussion in 2009, how do we replace our broken free market healthcare insurance system? Everyone said, well, we either go to a single-payer socialism or we leave it free market, there are everything. And there were a few economists like me, we were saying, why don't you do it like the Fed does? Just do it the same way. You have a health insurance company that is the government's, and you have health insurance companies that are the private sector's, because we know this model has worked for a century, for God's sake. Why would you want to do something other than this? Well, no one listened to us. They just, and so they put together this thing called the Affordable Care Act. But it's an interesting thing. Here's a classic example of the public sector in direct competition with the private sector, and neither of them is hurt in the process, and the entire system is benefited. The last one is that the Fed conducts monetary policy. The Fed conducts monetary policy. It grows and contracts the money supply. Its duty is to maintain the stability of the aggregate price level. That's a fancy way of saying no inflations, no deflations. In other words, grow the money supply at the real at the growth rate of the real economy. If you grow the money supply faster, you create eventually inflation. If you grow the money supply slower, you eventually create a deflation. The idea that inflation can be caused by something other than the money supply's growth is a myth. So on the one hand, you'll say, well, that union wage went up, that's going to be inflationary. No, it's not. Or those companies over there, they raised their prices, that's inflationary. No, it's not. Because unless there is money to accommodate it, a price rise one place would cause a price fall the other place. You can't have magical inflation. The only thing that creates inflation is when the Fed grows the money supply too fast. The only thing that would create a deflation is if the Fed grew the money supply too slow. It has to grow at a sufficient rate to keep liquidity in the overlying economy. That's the Fed's job. The problem is that historically, there were times when the Fed acted politically under political pressure, and it didn't do its job. It poured money in to help the economy. Then sure enough, years later, there's a massive inflation, so it has to pull that money back in, and the economy falls into a recession. But I want to show you a graphic here to finish this up. Just to give you an idea, and putting a few of these ideas together, I'm going to go to this, and I'll give you the link to this. m1m2m3-2000.png. Now I want you to tell me what you see. It's going to take you a minute to look at it. We've got about 5 minutes here, 3 minutes. First of all, the Federal Reserve stopped publishing M3 in 2006 in the spring. It said, well, no one needs that anymore. That was not true. You see how M3 was growing at an insanely accelerating rate? This isn't the level of M3 money. This is the growth rate of M3 money. Do you see those euro dollars driving the M3 money supply aggregate upward at an accelerating rate? The growth rate had reached by 2008, early 2008, almost 18%. That is insane. The economy was growing at only about 3%. The Fed couldn't control M3 because that was just everyone buying stuff from overseas and those dollars accumulating in foreign reserves of other banks, mostly China or the oil-producing states. But there's more to it. Notice that M1, the money that households and businesses use, do you see how the Fed had cut its growth rate to zero? Do you see it? In other words, if the economy was growing at 3%, the M1 should have been growing at 3%, and yet the Fed was zeroing out its growth. The reason it was doing that probably was because it was trying to control M2 and M3 because they know that M1 is embedded in M2 and M3. M1 and M2 are. So what it was trying to do was throttle M1 to try to control M2 and M3. It wasn't working because it was just too fast the growth was. That's why the Fed stopped publishing M3. It was just a nosebleed scary thing. It was just ridiculous. And finally, you don't give the economy liquidity. The economy is growing at 3%, but you're not putting enough lubricant in the engine to keep it going. Well, there's your answer to why we buckled in September of 2008. The economy simply ran out of money because the Fed was not growing the money supply, and yet the economy was growing. Now for an interesting thing. A lot of people say, well, what was this spike right here? What was that all about? Oh, that was 9/11. There was a real fear that when the attacks were leveled on New York City and the Pentagon, that people would freak and run their banks. And so the trucks went out from the Fed with real cash money, just poured it into the banks all over the country to make sure the banks would not go under with excessive demand for deposits. Turned out people actually didn't freak out. They didn't run to their banks, hardly at all. And so the Fed pulled the money back in and shredded it up a few months later. But there's a little story in here. You see the spike? That's September 11th. What's going on? That's late July and August. Look at that. Do you see it? Do you see what that means? Why if 9/11 was the reason the Fed poured all that money into the banks, why in the hell would the Fed have been pouring the money into the banks in August? The spike, the very top, this had been going on for weeks at least before 9/11. The banks had been getting massive amounts of liquidity. Why would that be if nobody could possibly have imagined that there would be an attack on 9/11? That's all I have for you tonight. Thank you.